So I want to start discussing Hanukkah today. The Hanukkah is next Tuesday night, so it's time to get ready. Tuesday, I think, right? Tuesday night? I think Tuesday. Tuesday night.
Right? Next Tuesday?
Am I wrong? Is Monday night?
The 12th.
Monday night was.
I thought it was Tuesday night, but it could be I'm wrong.
The 12th.
We can count.
We can figure it out.
Shoulders was Sunday.
Yes. So work from there. Okay, so Hanukkah, and I think this is true about many, many holidays, but I think Hanukkah in particular, we're given, Tuesday night. We're given a description of Hanukkah as little kids, you know, in nursery school or in preschool, and that sticks to us for our entire lives. And we look at Hanukkah from a very, very, I don't know what to call it, childish angle, but a very, very simple angle, and we often miss the depth of what it's all about. It's true with many parts of Judaism, for many of us, not just Hanukkah, but I think Hanukkah in particular, being that it's something which everybody talks about, Jew and non-Jew alike, and something that we were hammered with as kids in terms of the simple story, we very often do not advance past the simple story into the more complex, profound issues of Hanukkah. So every year, especially when it comes to Hanukkah, I like to bring out the deeper points of Hanukkah, so we see there's much more to this holiday than just the simple story of a war which we won and oil lasting 8 days, which obviously is the climax of the story. But what is the actual battle that we're talking about? What is this tension? What was the conflict? What was the result? Beyond that, you know, the Jews, unfortunately, we've had in history, you know, probably hundreds of times where nations have come and oppressed us, have tried to deprive us of our religious practices and ban them. And we don't make a holiday every single time this occurred. Hanukkah has become a holiday for all generations. It's rabbinic, it's not from the Torah, it's a rabbinic holiday. But the rabbis deemed Hanukkah to be a model for us of this clash of our religion versus others coming to stop our religion. And the victory of Hanukkah was something which is a very clear miracle, which thereby indicated to the Chachamim they should make a holiday out of it. But ultimately, you know, what is it about Hanukkah? What's this battle that we're discussing? What is the clash over here? What should we gain from it nowadays? Now, we live Hanukkah yearly. Now, what are we supposed to be reflecting upon? So there's a point which I've spoken about in previous years, but I was trying to take a different angle on it. But it's, I think, really a central point of Hanukkah. And just to start the idea, you know, the Hanukkah is the battle against the Yavanim, the Greeks, the Greek culture. That's what Hanukkah is historically. Alexander the Great came in and conquered most of the known world in those days. The Greek Empire had taken over the entire world, and their influence, their culture, had really spanned the entire world at that point. They invaded into the land of Israel as well, both physically and culturally. The culture of Greece, the Greek culture, was in Eretz Yisrael, and that was the tension which occurred during the Hanukkah story. And to this very day, you know, we who live in the Western world, as we call it, we are very much a product of the ancient Greek culture. We speak about, you know, Greco-Roman, you know, culture and ideals. It comes from Greece, it comes from Rome, and that's what we have this very day in our Western minds, in Western thinking. So the question is, what's so bad about that? We talk about this as a clash of, and I look at it not just as a one-time battle, there's a clash of cultures which occur. There's a clash of two different cultures, the culture of the Greeks, the culture of the Jews. And that was the struggle of Hanukkah. It wasn't a one-time oppression. It wasn't just some decrees that were made by some ancient government 2,000 years ago. But rather, it's an epic clash of cultures which has to be dealt with. And that clash remains, to us, a issue to this very day. So what is that clash? And the truth is, you know, ancient Greece in our eyes is quite a glamorous society. We think about the philosophy and the science and the architecture and the art and everything which stemmed from that society to us are very positive things. The fact that nowadays we understand the world through the eyes of science, that was really an innovation of Greek society. Before that, everything was kind of attributed to superstition, you know, the different type of pagan gods, the gods do this and the gods do that, but there's no human explanation to understand the world. And the Greeks introduced to us the idea the human mind is able to probe the world as we have in front of us and create scientific theories. And things are explainable and logical and things work out and they're rational. That was really a Greek innovation, which we have to this very day as a positive thing. The fact that we've advanced so much in technology, in medicine, know, in science, in the bigger sense, really all began back in the times of ancient Greece. That's where it all started historically. So what's so bad about this? Is this really something that clashes with Torah? Does it fit with Torah? How do we regard this? And I want to be very, very clear. We don't look at it as bad essentially. It's not essentially bad. It's only bad if it's in the wrong context. That concept of Greek culture, and let's just, for simplicity's sake, let's call it, you know, the ideas of science and philosophy, which I think are probably the primary different the contributions of Greece to the world. Those are seen by us not as essentially bad things, but only bad when they're you put in the wrong context. And I'll explain what that means. But I'm going to start with an analogy. You know, unfortunately, you hear in the news, you know, periodically, these terrible, terrible stories of, let's say, a child that was born in captivity. You know, somebody was kidnapped, and then they have a child, and the child grows up in a house and never leaves the house. And then we hear in miraculous stories how eventually somebody discovered it and freed the child. I picture a child like that. So again, it's terrible, terrible torture, being held captive. But this child being born in a house like this, this child is not privy to the fact that there's a world outside. This child's never seen that world, never been part of that world. For all this child knows, the only world is this, you know, this basement that they're stuck in, this dungeon that they're locked in. That's all there is to life, and there's nothing beyond that. And even if the child is well cared for, you know, they're fed, and they're given clothing, and they're given medicine when needed, we still see this as one of the worst forms of torture, because you've deprived a human being of life. You know, you've imprisoned a human being for no fault of their own, and they're not even aware of the light outside, of what's out there. They're so confined, they're so constricted, and they can't even perceive a world beyond that which they're in. You picture somebody that's, you know, colorblind, you try to describe to them colors. It just doesn't work. There's a whole world of color that you try to, but they've never experienced it before. And for them, you know, they're limited because they can't see color. So there's a bigger world beyond, and this kid who's stuck down here in this basement or this dungeon, wherever they're stuck, their scope of life is very, very limited. It's small and confined. We would call this the living in a world of darkness. You know, darkness limits you. In the dark, you can't see past your face. In the dark, you can't see what's around you. When you're in the light, you can see things much further. So somebody's living life like that, I say they're not really living. You know, they're missing out on what life is. So to take that analogy and understand it, you know, we would look, if we take the accomplishments of ancient Greece, you know, the whole world, let's call it of science and philosophy, and we were to isolate it as this is the be-all, end-all of truth. This is all that the life's all about. So essentially what they're talking about is a world focused on the human mind. Their take on truth and morality has to be, even the spirituality is totally based on how they deem it true based on their own minds. The only thing that matters to them is that which the human mind understands. But anything beyond, man is the one who determines truth, and there's nothing beyond that. So let's give another analogy to this. The tools which the Greek mind, the ancient Greek mind, determines truth by are the tools we have in our world that are around me. So my tools are the tools to measure the world around me, and the Greek has a very small world to measure. To give another analogy, I walk in the room, and I tell you, there's no such thing as atoms. Atoms don't exist. So you'll say, why? You're denying science? Well, I say, well, I'm looking around right now, I don't see any atoms. I'm looking everywhere. Do you see any atoms? I don't see any atoms. And you tell me, no, Rabbi Shir, you got it all wrong. You have to take out a special microscope to see anything about an atom. They're too small for you to see it with your eye. So I say, great. So I go to the dollar store, I buy a little magnifying glass, and look around again, I don't see anything. Right? So you'll tell me I'm a fool, because I'm just using the wrong tools. It's not that atoms don't exist, it's just that I don't have the right tools to detect them. But if I have the right tools, I can find that these things actually do exist. The Greek mind is, this is what the Ramban says, Nachmanides describes. Ramban describes, he says that those students of who calls the Yavani, the Greek, meaning Aristotle, the way they view life is that they deny anything that they cannot sense through their five senses. And they say that anything that they can understand with their own logical mind, they say is not true. That's the quote from the Ramban. Meaning that the basis of science is that I can explain everything with my mind. Now, if I have the right tools, I look around the world, I can make observations, I can test, I can make experiments, and eventually I can come out with laws of science. And that's true. That's true that there are laws of science in the world. The world is scientific. The world does respond to does it follow a pattern. It really does. I think there's a quote from Einstein, I believe. He says that the most incomprehensible thing about the world is that's comprehensible. Meaning, there's no, if you're not religious, there's no reason the world should make sense. Everything developed randomly. Like, who made the laws of nature? Like, why should there be laws in the first place? And the very fact that nature has laws and it makes sense, that itself is a miracle of God. So that was Einstein's observation, I believe. But the Greek mind says, if I can observe it as a law of nature, then it's true, it exists. If I can't observe it, then it can't exist. It's the approach of the human mind determining all. Everything has to fit into a test tube, be measured with a ruler, be given an equation. But if it can't be one of those things, then it can't be reality. So this is the theory of the essential Greek theory, which is out there. This is the scientific theory. So we would say, well, you're missing something. We'd say that you're just lacking. So the Greek mind would say, well, there's not one God who's incomprehensible to us. There's no one infinite God because you can't understand that. They would say the Torah doesn't make sense because these laws are not always rational to us. We don't always understand all the laws of the Torah. It doesn't make sense. I can't test them scientifically to show they're right. There's nothing that science will teach us about we're eating meat and milk, which is really a bad thing. You can't find a soul with a microscope. You can't use a telescope to see angels. It just doesn't work. It's the wrong tools. So the Greek mind will say, well, I can't scientifically prove it. It can't be true. The Torah says, well, you have the wrong tools. All the tools you have are tools that are only able to detect things in the physical world as we have it. But the things that we're discussing from the Torah, you know, God and souls and mitzvos and averos and punishment and reward and divine providence, etc., all these things, they cannot be tested scientifically. There's no scientific tool that was ever created, that could ever be created, to detect these things. It's just not the same thing. The tools of science are extremely limited. They can only see what they can see, and that's it. They're very powerful tools, and you know, at this day and age, we have tools that can see incredible things scientifically. But those tools just won't do the trick. So it's important for us. The Torah perspective is that science is absolutely correct, but in the arena in which it's talking about. Science is supposed to be describing to us the world as we see it in the physical world. And everything science observes, there's no reason that the Torah should say is not true. We very much appreciate it. We're happy with all the scientific advances in history, and we'll appreciate all the medicine and everything else which science has produced for us, and it's all correct. But there's a point, they have to understand that they're limited to one scope. And where you cross the line, the reason that you have scientists who are atheists is because they're saying, well, since religion isn't scientific, can it be right? My mind can't understand that, it can't be right. And this is coming from this ancient Greek philosophy, which the Ramban's pointing out, of Aristotle and his students, that if it's not rational or logical and it can't be explained scientifically, it just can't be true. So we know that 1,000 years ago, the tools they had in science were not all that advanced. And so many things that scientists are saying nowadays in 2017, 1,000 years back, they would have said it's ridiculous. That can't be true. And we say, yeah, we've proven it because we have new tools to prove these things. It's all about the tools you have to detect. So even if you develop the best scientific tools in the world, a science will just never be able to address religion. The two things just don't go together. And forget religion. A science, you can't take a microscope and see justice. Justice is a concept, and microscopes see things that are physical. It just doesn't work. It's just the wrong tools. You can't take a microscope and see kindness. It just doesn't go. But it's not the right tools to see kindness with. So that's how we have to understand that science is a very valuable thing, but if it's put in the proper context. We have to understand science limits a person. It's limiting you to a certain view of the world, not because nothing exists beyond that, but because science just can't deal with things beyond that. So you talk about this, that we use the example of a kid who grew up in a basement, unfortunately not able to see the world. So if you look at science, this is my only way to determine truth. So what we're doing is we're locking yourselves into a very small bubble. We're saying that nothing can exist beyond this. And we're depriving ourselves of understanding there's a world that goes far beyond the physical scientific world. A world that's infinite, that's beautiful, that contains spiritual pleasures and the reward for mitzvos and everything else. But I'm denying it all because I can't find it with my telescope. So that's a very limiting approach. That's a very foolish approach because we have to understand that it's not out there. It's just that we don't have the tools to detect it. And that's our problem. To give another analogy, which I think will bring out a different point. Now, I was thinking about, if you ever go on Google Earth, you ever do Google Earth? So Google Earth, you start off with the big globe in front of you. Then you'll type in Silver Spring, Maryland, right? And it zooms in to Silver Spring, Maryland. And you see all the details of the streets. You can even turn on you can see the satellite image. You can see your house and the trees. You see a lot of details. But when you zoom out, you see an entire world and a much broader picture. So when you zoom in, if you understand, I'm seeing a tiny, tiny part in detail of a much bigger world. So then that's the right approach, because you understand that the world is not Silver Spring, Maryland. The world is much bigger than that, but I've chosen to zero in on one part of the world to see the detail and to understand more about it. If I were to zoom in on my Google map and then say that there's nothing past, this is it, right? That's all there is. So I'm a fool, because it's not that it doesn't exist, it's just that I'm not looking at it right now. I once saw as a joke, you have these, like, I think it was, said it was a New York map. So it was like New York, and then like the rest of the world, you know, that was the map.
It's true.
New York, okay,
yeah. Yes, it's true.
So it's the same thing. If I have to understand, I'm seeing science is merely showing me a section, one layer of the world. And it's showing me in detail, in very, very graphic and very accurate detail, that section of the world. But just one section. If I say this is it, this little point of Silver Spring, Maryland is all there is, I'm ignoring an entire universe out there. So then I'm limiting myself, I'm confined to a very small understanding, and I'm being very foolish. Because I'm thinking that the tool I'm using is showing me everything there is to see, and it's not true. This tool is only showing me one thing. It doesn't show me everything else, because that's not what it's programmed to do. So science is a very, very valuable tool, but it's a very limited tool. If I know what it's supposed to be detecting, and I understand what these tools are supposed to do, then it's the correct approach, and it's very, very valuable. Because I know this is what science is supposed to address, a certain area of life, and a very large area, an important area of life. That's what it's supposed to address. If it addresses that, it does great. But we have to know reality is not based on that. That doesn't make or break reality. Reality is something which goes beyond what science can talk about and prove. And if I don't understand that, it's like looking for atoms with a magnifying glass. I'm just missing the boat. You see, science shows you a very, very detailed and helpful picture, but just one layer of reality. That's all it's showing you. So this is really the epic battle. Besides, you know, there's a physical battle, and there are physical decrees of the Greeks upon the Jews, but it stemmed from a much deeper spiritual and philosophical source, which the Greeks said that science is what determines truth. The human mind has to understand everything. Philosophy means that my mind has to be able to understand it. Philosophy doesn't talk about things that are not comprehensible, things that are comprehensible. And that's what philosophy was, and that's what science is. So the Greeks said that's what life's all about. That's all there is. And there's nothing more. And we can't discuss anything that's more. The people always ask me, well, what about the fact that the Greeks, they were religious, they had gods. But the answer is, we all know, if you ever read Greek mythology, their gods are just super, super humans. I mean, they're human beings with the same problems we have, just a little extra, a little stronger, a little smarter or something. But there's nothing about them that's incomprehensible. Everything had to be comprehensible, because it had to fit the human mind. We say that Hashem is not comprehensible to us. He is infinite, all-powerful, all-knowing, and we can't understand Hashem. The Greeks fully understood their gods to the degree that their gods were basically human beings with a little extra strength. Your question? Yeah.
What is true about their multitude of gods who make love and who struggle and who commit crime? What is uplifting and interesting about the gods of Greece?
You're asking the wrong person. I don't know.
It's a man.
I'm not sure, but it's all myths. It's just men. It's just men and women. That's
it's
all their
mess.
Gods were.
It's messy.
And it's messy. It's like a soap opera. But I don't know, but my point is that they had to create gods that were totally understood by humans. They couldn't have, there's nothing about their gods that was beyond human beings. Nothing supernatural about them, except for the fact that they may have been stronger than us. Which, you know, Lahavdil, very different is the approach to Hashem, which is that he is not comprehensible to us. You know, Hashem reveals to us a little bit of what he's about, and that's it. But we can't understand Hashem, and we can't understand the infinite nature of Hashem, and the all-powerful and all-knowing nature of Hashem, and Hashem has no desires, Hashem doesn't steal, and Hashem doesn't have lust. But the Greek gods all had these things. So it's all the same idea. It's the same idea that everything had to fit into their minds, everything had to be comprehensible, And if not, it couldn't be. It just couldn't exist. So then they've put themselves in this box. They've limited themselves to a very small understanding of reality. So we look at science, we say it's very progressive. You know, science is something which has brought the world to a much greater point. And the truth is that it is progressive, it's also limiting. Because if it's put in the wrong perspective, you've limited yourself greatly to a very, very small image of what life's all about. So, you have more question? Yeah.
But the Greeks will tell you, not only we had Euclides and Pythagore and Archimedes, but we invented democracy, we invented theater.
Right, these things I'm saying are could be good in the right context.
And democracy right. has nothing to do with science, they will tell you.
Okay.
Democracy has nothing to do. So we have brought many good things to civilization. Why right. do you focus on science? What would you answer them?
Okay, so I will agree. Greece brought many, many things to the world, many things about culture, modern government. You're 100% right. Philosophy, we've spoken a little bit too. But just the
Architecture,
correct. It's the whole concept of modern culture. But all these things, it's the realm of human accomplishment. It's the realm where everything that the human being can say is my accomplishment, what I've developed, and it's all coming from their approach. It all has to be something that the humans have done. It's very humans. Very human-centered.
It's all physical,
right?
Spiritual.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that what they contribute is bad. I'm just saying that there's a limiting approach to it. There's many sources to say that Greece is very, very good from a Torah perspective, as long as they're put into the right context. We understand that culture. Architecture, music, forms of government, these things are very, very positive as long as we understand that if I reach a point that that's beyond me, there's a God above who runs the world. But if I say this is what life's all about and it ends right here, whatever I accomplish is all that life's all about, it's all about me and what I do, then that's a limiting perspective and that's considered bad in Jewish thought. Science the Greek philosophy and science doesn't allow for miracles. It doesn't allow for divine intervention. It doesn't allow for any form of hashkacha, any form of divine providence. It doesn't allow for that because it's not scientific. It's not comprehensible. They look at the way that we approach the world, and we approach history, and they'll say you're being very, very superstitious and archaic because you're saying there's a God running the picture. We can't understand that. We don't see that. That can't be. Yeah.
Did they say that about their own religions?
I don't know enough to answer that question. I'm not sure, but.
One follow-up, if I can, quickly.
But they definitely will speak about their gods intervening. But their gods, again, were just human beings with super strength intervening. I don't know beyond that what they held. I'm not sure. Yeah.
Plato can tell you, I discovered the world of ideas. They even came to the conclusion that there is a God. What would you answer him?
Well, but there's a God because you concluded it.
What?
It's a God because you decided there's a God. That God's still coming from you and not from the fact that there's an all-knowing God.
But it has to come from within me, no?
You have to come to belief in God, but we don't say there's a God because I decided so. We have a tradition. We say, even if I don't understand who God is and what God does, there's still a God. The approach has to start from me, and then I believe because of my own personal thoughts that's not a Torah approach. We should come to our own belief as well, but that's not a Torah approach. And again, it's this. So people talk about there's a conflict of science and religion. I think that this is the wrong way to describe it. It's not a conflict. It's just two different systems of looking at the world. Again, another analogy. I'll tell you, I don't like vanilla ice cream. And you'll say why? Well, because my bowl is 6 inches tall. So. It's described as separate things. The flavor of the ice cream and the size of the bowl is nothing to do with each other. So I say there's no God because I couldn't measure God. The answer is okay, but it's two separate things. So there's no conflict. It's not a conflict. It's just a matter of putting things in perspective in the proper way. Science deals with science, religion is religion, and the two don't need to cross. And the two in many ways can't cross because there's just two separate systems that work together, but they're separate. So the miracles of Hanukkah, you have oil burning for 8 days. There's enough oil to burn for one day, it burns for 8 days. So we can make a scientific equation, and it doesn't make any sense. How could that be? And then I worked out the amount of oil and the size of the wick and the heat of the fire and all the weather conditions around, and just the math doesn't work out. So we say, yeah, but that doesn't matter, because the whole system of science comes from God. There's things that cannot be detected through science, and this is beyond that. There has to be always an understanding that even, like we mentioned from Einstein, that even the laws of nature are only there because God put them into place. And if God put them into place, God can also change them. God can also waive them temporarily. There's a very famous story in the Gemara about the daughter of Rabbi Hanina ben Dosa, that she was sad. One Friday night, she was very sad because she put vinegar in the candles instead of oil. So she was sad. I guess it wasn't time to switch it, or she didn't have anything else to light. So her father comes, who is known to be a miracle worker, and her father says, "What's the problem?" He said, "The one who said that oil should ignite, because the vinegar didn't ignite." And she lit it, and it burned like a candle. So the point being that science is limited to tell you that oil lights, but God could say, why should oil light today? Vinegar can light today, and that's also fine. And the Jewish approach is that the laws of science, they're true, and they're expected, and we can count on them, but they don't determine truth. God determines truth, and God can even determine the laws of science don't have to apply today. I actually like to think that it's a kindness from God that we can count on science. Meaning, if today water is healthy and tomorrow water is poisonous, I won't know if I can have a drink today because things change. If today there's gravity and tomorrow there's not, so then life would be really topsy-turvy. We wouldn't know, should we like tie everything down or should we not tie? Like, we wouldn't know what to do. If today we breathe oxygen and tomorrow we breathe carbon dioxide, so then somebody who's having oxygen, we have to sweat. Everything would be very strange. So God lets us, the world is predictable. The world makes sense to us, and we're able to act based on that. But if God says one day, okay, we're going to suspend the rule that oil burns and make vinegar burn, so then he can do that too, because even though that's not something science could detect, that's not expected and that's not observable every single day, that's the true look at science. It comes from God and is a system that goes beyond. There's a world of the soul, and the soul is not, again, I don't know what ancient Greeks say about a soul, I don't know the answer to that question, but a soul is not scientific. A soul is not something, you can't do surgery and find your soul. You can't see it in an x-ray machine. It just doesn't work, because it's not physical, it's spiritual. There's ideas of hashkacha, of seeing divine providence, and we're never going to actually, we can tell stories and say that must have been divine providence. There's many, many books written about that, but you can't prove it. There's no way you can take any sort of tool and say, I saw God doing something over there. It's just, it's not something that we can determine. We believe in the idea of malachim, of angels, but you can't see an angel, you can't find them with any sort of equation. The world of science, it's just, it keeps us in a bubble. And in the modern world, we get stuck in a bubble sometimes. All of us, sometimes, we end up with questions about our religion, because our minds are trained to think in that bubble. And we have to be able to burst out of that bubble and say it's just not true. Even if science might pose a question about religion, the answer is, well, it's the wrong tool to talk about religion. It just doesn't work. It can't be that way. Yeah.
Okay, two questions. You agree that Maimonides was knew about Plato,
yes,
Socrates, and Aristotle.
Yes.
And they had some influence on his,
yes,
right?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, number one. Number two, when you draw a diameter of radius 1 and you draw a circle, the area of the circle and half of the circumference equal pi. And pi has an infinite decimal sequence. There you meet God. So math and yeah, God are...
Okay, I see math and science as very much supporting God.
I find God in math.
So it's not a mathematical proof. It's a support. That's the big difference. You can't prove.
Support.
It's a support. Yeah, math and science can certainly support Emunah.
You want infinity? Draw a circle of radius 1.
Right.
And you have infinity. Right away. Instantly, in 1 second.
Right.
We are drowned in infinity.
Got it. I agree with your statement very much that math and science, I believe, are very supportive of a God. I think that you look at the fact that the world of science is so precise shows there's a divine plan in the world. I think that's clear. But you can't make a mathematical proof for God, and then that's the difference. There's no way to you can't prove. You can just bring strong supports. your first point is a good point to discuss. I mean, we have many of our great sages, Rambam in particular. The Rambam praised Aristotle to no end. The Rambam said that whatever Aristotle said about things of our world, he was 100% right. But when he started speaking about things that are beyond, he was wrong. That's what Rambam said. Because again, what the Greeks accomplished, we do respect and appreciate, put in the right context. And that's the important point. We don't look at it as a form of evil that is totally like taboo and off limits, and we very much appreciate what they do. But it has to be put into the right context. There's another big claim, you know, I don't call it a Greek claim or a scientific claim, and this is a claim we hear to this very day. You know, people will say religion is something which is archaic, it's old, it's antiquated, and the progressive minds, you know, they look at the world from a much more rational perspective. Religion is irrational, and therefore it's like superstitious, it's old. And that's a claim which we've heard for centuries, and to this very day, people still have that claim. Some people view people who are religious as kind of, you know, you're coming out of a different century. You know, that's not what the modern mind believes. And where does that feeling come from? So I actually heard a very beautiful idea on last week's parsha. We know that Yaakov Avinu is coming back to the land of Israel to see his father, and he had to cross back over the river, and he was attacked by the angel of Esav. And the Torah describes Vayabik Ishimo, they had a wrestling match. Esav's angel and Yaakov, it's the famous match of those two. And at the end, you know, it seems that Yaakov wins the battle, but he walks away limping. So the Torah describes it Vayabik Ishimo, that the word used for wrestling there is Vayabik. And the word Yaabik comes from the word Avak, dust. And Rashi describes, and many of the commentators describe, that's because when you're wrestling on the ground, dust rises. But it's a funny thing, like, why is the focal point of the Torah on the dust rising? Like, talk about the battle. Why do we care that dust rose from it? Additionally, the sages tell us that dust rose all the way to the Kisei Kavod, to God's divine throne. So what does that mean? I mean, again, it's not physical. Like, the dust can't rise to the divine throne. What does it mean you got the divine throne dusty? Like, what could that mean exactly? So we view this battle as a battle. You know, the angel of Esav is viewed for us as a representation of the forces of evil, of Yetzer Hara, of all the challenges we have in the service of God. And many commentaries look at this battle, and they find in this battle different hints to how the Yetzer Hara and how the forces of evil come to draw us away from serving God. So in every step of the battle, there's different allusions and different ideas about how the Yetzer Hara attacks us. So one idea I heard was that the idea of the dust is that when things become dusty, what does it mean in our minds? They're old, they lose their shine, they're not very exciting. You know, you go to the old dusty attic, you have all the old dusty things in the old dusty attic. It means things are old and they're out of date and they're obsolete. That's what dust conjures up in our minds. Something which was shiny, it's dusty, it's no longer shiny anymore. And one of the ploys of the world of evil, of the Yetzer Hara, of all the forces that draw us away from doing the right things, is to make us think that, you know, religion is old and dusty. And God, the belief in God, is an old superstition, it's old and dusty, and the Torah's laws, they're antiquated and they're out of date, they're irrelevant, they're all old and dusty. And we live in an enlightened world. We live in a world of the mind, of understanding. We're much more progressive, we're much more advanced. And this religion stuff is for the antiques. That's what it's for. It's for the antique store. You could put it up in a museum as a museum piece, but it's not reality. It's all dusty. And that was one of the different forms of evil, one of the forms of philosophy to draw us away from God that Esav's angel injected into life, you know, during that battle. This is the idea that I heard. And it's an interesting idea because, you know, that there is an attitude like that. And sometimes, you know, we even feel that ourselves sometimes. You know, I'm doing something that seems so ancient. And so sometimes I feel it's so irrelevant to me. And the problem is it's wrong because the people who are saying this, they're in the dark and we're in the light. Because they're only saying that because they're using the wrong tool to measure it. If they had the right tools, they'd see that they're right about science. But there's a world of truth that goes so far beyond that, and a mitzvah is something which is very, very exciting. The Torah is always fresh and relevant. You know, God is there with us every single moment, and God is alive and well, but since they didn't see that with their tools, they're not able to appreciate that. But the Torah teaches us that this is the wrong approach. The approach is that the Torah is new and fresh and exciting at all times. The Torah is relevant at all times. God is always alert and engaged with the world. He never gets dusty. His throne doesn't get dusty. But the forces of evil sometimes are able to make us think that Torah got dusty and old. So Hanukkah comes along, and Hanukkah is the battle of dark versus light. the Torah is Or, Torah is light. We light the menorah on Hanukkah, that brings light to the world. And we refer to, the rabbis tell us that the ancient Greek philosophy is called choshech, it's called darkness. And the idea of the darkness and light is that darkness, again, limits you. I can't see past myself when I'm in the darkness, but light allows me to see much further. And the battle we have here, light versus darkness, is this battle of how do we view the contributions of ancient Greece from the Torah perspective. The answer is that they are darkness unless they're put with the light. When you turn on a light in the darkness, so the darkness also becomes light. But if you leave it alone, it's just darkness. It's limiting. It's interesting, the Hebrew word for darkness is choshech, which you could read those letters as well as chasach, which is to be held back. The Hebrew word for or, for light is or, which also relates to the word avir, which is space. You know, air, space. Because light gives you a much broader perspective, and choshech, darkness, gives you a much more limited perspective. And that's the world of Greece is very much limits us. So it's not bad, it's just limiting unless you put in the right perspective. So Hanukkah is a time to reflect upon this idea. There's a ticket to see the depth of the world on Hanukkah. You're able to understand that our world goes so far beyond that which the people in the Western culture might proclaim to us is reality. There's a broad view of reality, of Hashem, of divine plans, you know, divine providence. Science is one window into the world, but Hanukkah tells us that there's a lot bigger picture which you're missing. You know, zoom out from that little dot in the Google Maps and then see the big world in front of you. That's the message of Hanukkah. So as we light candles and we bring light to the world, it's our job to understand that the light of Torah is something which really enlightens us to show us, you know, true reality, and the darkness of Greece limits us. And this is our approach. If we were to ask the question, in my mind, if we ask the question, you know, how does the Torah view science? How does the Torah view philosophy? How does the Torah view the contributions of ancient Greece to the world? We say the Torah thinks that they're wonderful and that they're great as long as they're in the right perspective. As long as you know that it's only giving you the one angle on reality. But as soon as you say that this is what life's all about, this is what is true in the world, and there's nothing beyond science and philosophy and the accomplishments of human beings, at that point, we look at that as a heretical thought and a very limiting thought, because now you've closed yourself into this dark room and you can't see anything beyond that. So there's one idea of Hanukkah which certainly is much deeper than you're taught in nursery school.
They predicted atoms. Greeks predicted.
Picked atoms, interesting. Yeah, okay. Good. Yeah, we
don't
know.
It was a different idea.
Another debate.
But square root of two.